Here's Johnny.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
Here. I don't know what the hell's in there. It's weird and pissed off, whatever it is.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Yes. To kill a lot of people!
I've got some problems here!
Well, you listen good, Skank. I know it's gonna be hard with your melon on chemical overload. But there's a killer out there, and I'm gonna track the hairball down. So when you two crater heads get finished mining for nose gold and you get a relapse of memory, you let me know, huh?
Huh, humans? Ain't nothing but nothing. Y'all run like scared little rabbits.
Is it possible we didn't find all of her victims? If we didn't find all the victims, if there are others besides the girl in the park,
the thing would spread.
In a chain reaction, geometrically, until by now. Oh, Christ.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.
Welcome to Screen Talk Radio. This is Chris Wainer, your host, along with Devin Watson from ScreenWritersUtopia.com. In honor of the upcoming Friday the 13th that we've chosen horror writing as our theme tonight, and potential, hopefully tonight's call-in guests will be on their best game, but if not, we've got the proper theme for tonight's segment with our call-in with Christopher Lockhart from William Morris. If this is your first time listening, Devin and I usually take a few minutes to kind of talk about a topic of interest, kind of debated. Usually I end up being right, and Devin submits and agrees that he's wrong. Devin's here joining us again tonight. Devin's got his first film coming out this summer, a horror film called The Cursed, and also a book coming out through Michael Wiese Productions. Devin, we have a contest, that opening clip. Now, we're not going to replay it, but you can download our show later on tonight or tomorrow. But the first two people to email me at editor@screenwritersutopia.com, the proper order of all 14 clips from that horror piece, along with the actor, will get a special prize. And, you know, we got software, books, but you'll be able to download it later tonight or tomorrow, so you can replay it and try to come up with it's 14 sound clips from 14. Actually, it's not 14. There's one that's twice, but it's of various horror films. Also, for those of you who are listening and want to pitch your screenplay to Christopher Lockhart, later on we'll be taking those calls around 6:20. The boards are already lit up. So if you are listening and want to call in and it's busy, be patient. When we start taking those calls, callers will be dropping off and you'll be able to call in. So make sure you stay around. Devin, back to horror writing. Go ahead, Devin.
I was going to say, be sure to turn your speakers down when you are on the air. Otherwise, we'll get some feedback, and it'll get really confusing.
Yeah, definitely. If you're listening to it on our site, go ahead and pause that when you are on hold. Plus, when you're on hold, I think you can hear the show anyways. So, Devin, back to horror writing. How far or low has the genre gone since Hitchcock's classic Psycho from 1960? If you look at IMDb, Psycho is the number one rated horror flick, of course, written by Joseph Stefano, adapted by Robert Bloch's novel. How far has horror writing evolved or digressed?
Well, I'd say if you look at the bottom 10 of the bottom-rated horror movies on IMDb, 7 out of those 10 come from the last 9 years. And that, I think, it's developed a lot of apathy, I think. There are, of course, lots of remakes, like the upcoming Friday the 13th, coming out in 2 days. People are not seeing, I think, the scare anymore. Your top 50 rated horror films on IMDb, they're all, with the exception of maybe two or three, they're all from like 1980 back. And I think that's a shame. I think we need to revitalize this genre. It may be just in a cocoon state right now, and it's needs something to really kick it in the butt. But I think it's definitely.
So you're saying that you agree that the genre has gone down? Because I don't. I think if you look at movies like Saw, you know, I think the psychological thriller horror film, and then, you know, certainly since Alien, you know, the sci-fi horror, think I think you know, also we're looking at where genres. I mean, really, when have you seen this appear? And that's the slasher flick. When have you seen this appear? Horror film nowadays. I mean, there's so many different variables in terms of a story being, you know, partially a thriller, partially a sci-fi, partially a horror film. I mean, is there even really such a thing as a pure horror film? And are those really discriminated against? Because it seems like someone sees just a regular slasher flick that comes out, and they immediately just say, well, that was stupid. But yet, you know, if you're an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid going to movie theater, you got your girlfriend with you, you wonder, you know, you went in your arms because of that scary slasher flick.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, I mean, the modern 18 to 25-year-old audience is going to go see a horror film. When they think horror, I mean, when I say horror, what do you automatically think of? You probably think of a couple teenagers, scantily clad women running around in the woods, being stalked by a guy with an axe or a machete. And that's really only one kind of horror film there is. That's actually gone to an extreme almost with gore for gore's sake, with torture porn and things like that, which I would actually put most of your Saw movies into, because that they just glorify the gore and forget story.
Well, I want to encourage writers who are still in the genre of horror writing to keep it up, because I think that the genre still got a lot of room for maneuver. I want to mention tonight's sponsors, Final Draft. If you're not using Final Draft, well, you're not using what the pros are using. So make sure to check out Final Draft. That's www.finaldraft.com. Also, ScriptShark, offering tools for the serious writer. ScriptShark.com. That's www.scriptshark.com. All right, news piece we want to mention real quick before we get to Script Girl. Milk screenwriter Dustin Lance Black has received the WGA West Paul Selvin Award. Black is up for the WGA Award and the Oscar for Original Screenplay for Focus Features biopic of pioneering gay political Harvey Milk. Milk is also in the running for the Best Picture for the Oscar. And Devin, if my notes are correct, I've got this one winning the Best Original Screenplay for the Oscar, and you have, of course, WALL-E. So this is proof once again that I'm going to be right and you're going to be wrong.
Only time will tell.
You're going to have to be the one doing the embarrassing thing on your life. Okay, let's go to Script Girl live from Hollywood, and then we'll bring in our special guest.
Hi, this is Script Girl in Hollywood with your weekly script sales report for Friday, February 6, 2009. First up, Alan Loeb adapted Jeffrey Eugen Dittes' short story, The Baster, for Mandate Pictures and Bonafide Productions. Jennifer Aniston and Jason Bateman will star in the come-hither comedy about an insecure neurotic who, upon learning his best friend is planning to have a child through artificial insemination, surreptitiously swaps the donor's special sauce for his own. Albert Berger and Jan Erzer will produce. Will Speck and Josh Gordon, the directors of Blades of Glory, are slated to helm the project. Loeb is repped by CAA. The master of horror, John Carpenter, will finally return to the director's chair for first-time feature scribe Sean and Michael Rasmussen's psychological thriller, The Ward. The Echo Lake Spooktacular takes place in a mental institution where a young female patient is repeatedly terrorized by ghosts. Doug Mankoff, Mike Marcus, Andy Spaulding, and Peter Block will produce. Stephen Dalian will write Moneyball for DeLuca Productions. Based on Michael Lewis's best-selling book, the sports drama highlights the career of Oakland Athletics GM Billy Bean and his innovative and uber-efficient computer analysis system. Brad Pitt is on deck to star. Steven Soderbergh will direct. And finally, Daniel Barnes will pen the adaptation of Alex Flynn's young adult novel Beastly for CBS Films and Storefront Pictures. The supernatural romp is about a popular teenage boy who's transformed into a hairy monster by a teenage witch in his class. Susan Cartonis will produce, Barnes will also direct. He's repped by the Endeavor Agency's Adriana Alberghetti. That's all for now. Remember, you can't sell it if you don't write it.
In addition to Script Shark being a sponsor, I want to mention that tonight's call-in winner who has her pitch selected by Chris will also receive a free posting on Script Shark's Spec Market, which is a great opportunity for yet more exposure to potential buyers for Hollywood. All right, I want to introduce our special guest tonight, Christopher Lockhart, who is the story editor for legendary talent agent Ed LaMotta at the William Morris Agency. Chris was nominated for a 2005 LA Area Emmy Award for The Inside Pitch, a televised version of his writing workshop. Chris could potentially find a project for his small list of A-list clients tonight, including Mel Gibson, Denzel Washington, Steve Martin, I say potentially. Chris, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to join us.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Devin. Hey, everybody. Let me give a shout-out to the two adverbs, to my two adverbs family. They may be listening. And to Laura Toffler, my old friend, who may be listening tonight, too. Laura, love, what's up?
All right. that's right. And all. You know, 200 of our other guests worldwide. Thank you for listening and joining us. The switchboard is lit up, man.
It's lit up.
We've got 30 people on hold right now.
Wow.
That's incredible. Because that's probably all 30 who are listening. But I don't know. It's pretty cool.
And it's my mother. It's my wife. It's my sister. It's probably my coworkers who are gonna, you know, try to call in and, you know, pull some pranks on me.
Well, they're probably already laughing because I think during the intro I didn't have my mic on mute, and I kind of let off a little burp there, and probably the whole world heard me say that. So
cool.
People are already laughing at us as it goes. So
all right, then I'm ready.
I got a new mic. I couldn't even mute it. But anyways, before we get to the calls, I want to ask you a real quick question. What you have a great analogy for the perfect pitch. Could you just quickly kind of tell us as, you know, someone who works as a story editor, what is for you the perfect pitch?
You know, I think probably the best pitch often starts off small. You know, so the writer doesn't try to tell me too much all at once. That's why I always think starting off with the genre and then starting off with a log line is just the best place to go. And then you can give a brief synopsis and slowly open up the story a little bit more, which then will kind of entice the listener to ask questions and say, okay, so now why does the character do that? Or, you know, tell me a little bit more about her. But I always think that you should start small as opposed to just throwing everything at the listener all at once. I think that's always a surefire way to bomb.
And, you know, that first opening few moments of a pitch, I mean, How much time does a writer typically have in a pitch session to really engage their audience?
Well, I think that depends upon who the writer is. But you know, if you're a new writer trying to break in, you probably don't have all that much time. But if you're actually in a meeting with somebody, you know, they've blocked some time away, and you know, so you've got some time. But yeah, you know, you want to try to hook the person in immediately. That's really always what it's about. I don't care who you are, you know, A-list or not. You always want to try to hook the listener in right away.
Real quick, before we get to our first caller, we're going to give each writer about 60 seconds. We reserve the right to hang up whenever we feel that it's just gone nowhere. Chris, feel free to interrupt them and ask them a question. I'm going to kind of take a cue from you. If you say thanks for your call, I'm going to take that as kind of a cue that we need to move on.
Okay.
Or if someone I feel is just totally out of line, I'll move on. But also for you, the writer who's listening right now, since we didn't have a screener tonight, I'm going to, before I introduce or say you're on live, I'm going to tell you the last two digits of the caller's number. So when I say those two digits, hopefully you know the freaking number you're calling from and know that we're calling on you. And once I pick your line, you will be live. Okay. So
I love this. This is high tech. This is high tech.
Yes, it's so high tech that you know, we only have a technical guy. So, all right, here we go. The first call we're going to take is the last two digits are 37. And I'm going to put you on here, and you're going to be live. Hello.
Hello.
You're live with Christopher Lockhart. You ready to pitch?
Wow.
Say, who is this, by the way?
My name's Lisa. I'm in Chicago, Illinois.
Hey, Lisa.
Chicago.
Hi.
Go ahead. You got 60 seconds, Lisa.
Okay. When 9-year-old Gordon Jenkins witnesses the murder of his grandmother by a schizophrenic mother, he goes to live in a boys' home run by a priest and is molested and abused. But when released at the age of 18, he stalks the priest and retaliates and seeks revenge.
Boy, that kid is—he's got a lot of bad luck. All right, you know, I think that my question would be, because probably half of that pitch was either backstory or the setup. So what I'd like to know is at what point in the script, like what page, does the 18-year-old boy set out to seek revenge on the priest? Where are we in the script at that point?
The beginning of the second act, right around page 30.
Okay. All right. That's a very good answer. All right. And what's the script called?
It's Misguided Trust.
And so when does the 18-year-old character enter the story? At what point? Like at what page?
He enters the story around page 6.
Page 6, all right. So we've only got like 5 pages of the 9-year-old boy.
Oh, no. He's the main character throughout the story after that because he grows up. And
right, yeah, right, right. So we're with the 9-year-old for just a few pages, and then we flash forward, and we're with the 18-year-old kid for the whole movie, correct?
That's right.
Okay. All right, very good.
Okay, Chris.
All right,
so
very good.
Should we put Lisa on the consider list, or are you going to pass?
Nope, I think that we could consider that.
Okay, Lisa, you're on the consider list. Please keep listening, and we'll announce at the end who is the finalist. Thank you, Lisa. All right, next caller with the ending number of 20, you are on. Hello, welcome to Screen Talk Live. You're on live with Christopher Lockhart. Who are we speaking with?
Hi, Chris. It's Art from Highland Park, Illinois.
Hey, Art. Boy, a lot of Illinois. All right.
Really?
What's going on?
Go ahead, Art.
Okay. In 1966, part-time soda jerk Rufus Shootergoose must find a real job to support his family. His father pushes him to become a financial success, but Rufus defies him by pursuing his dream of becoming a poet. I've got more. At each job Bia sets up, Rufus clashes with the boss until they fire him. It's always the world of imagination versus the world of earning a buck. Each lost job creates increasing fiction between Rufus and BS. The more father and son's battle intensifies, the more Rufus's brain fissures, eventually erupting and spitting out two competing characters, Kiddo, a wild and creative child, and Execufy, strange visitor from Wall Street.
Hmm. All right. Yeah, wow. It sounds a little bit sort of scattered to me. Maybe the Walter Mitty element is sort of interesting. But what are we rooting for in this?
You're rooting for this kid to fulfill his dream of becoming a poet, and he's really competing, you know, against a very strict father, and eventually his left side and his right side, it's a comedy, his left side and his right brain eventually explodes, and these two competing characters come out. You know,
it sounds maybe like you're trying to do a little bit of Charlie Kaufman there, which is not a bad thing, of course. But I have to say, and I know that a lot of my students and anybody who contributes to the message board at Two Adverbs is saying poet. That's just not a very. It's just not all that interesting. It certainly doesn't sound very very cinematic. You know, a guy who wants to be a poet. So it sounds very quirky, but I'm not really sure who the audience is for it, and it definitely sounds a little bit scattered. That's the word that I would use from the pitch. I think there are very interesting elements in it, but overall it sounds a little scattered, and I would pass on this.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Art. Good luck.
So, Chris, you got something against poets? I mean,
come on, poets is boring. Who wants to watch a movie about a poet? I mean, come on, give me a break.
So what, yeah, okay, all right, next up is 3-5, your last digits are 3-5.
Christopher, hi, this is
welcome.
Brad.
You're on live with Screen Talk. Who are we talking with?
This is Brad with from Long Beach, California. How are you guys?
Hey, Brad, Long Beach.
Long Beach, California. Hey, based on Christopher's requirements for a pitch, I'm going to be able to real quick pitch 4 quick projects.
Wow.
First one is Project Hitman, which is a dark comedy about a documentary film crew that chronicles the life and death of a modern-day hitman. Tagline is, everybody dies, not everyone kills. Second one, Angel Dog is a family film based on a girl's wish for a dog when it is answered beyond her imagination. Tagline is, have Halo, will...
Hello?
Which is a thriller about a...
Oh.
He's breaking up on me.
Yeah, I think we lost him.
Oh.
Brad, try to call back in.
Yeah, good luck, Brad.
Right. Next up is 91. Last digits are 91773 area code. Hello, you're live on Screen Talk Radio. Who are we speaking with?
Hi, this is Steve from Chicago.
Chicago? What is this? Wow. What is this in Illinois? Wow.
It's like a pipeline or something.
Crazy.
All right, Steve, go ahead.
Okay. Trauma is the true story of the greatest professional sports comeback of all time. Craig Gator Bodzanowski is an up-and-coming cruiserweight boxer who loses his focus and becomes reckless as he keeps winning. One day while riding his motorcycle, he's in a horrific accident that shatters his right leg, and eventually they have to amputate. The day after the operation, Gator starts to make plans for his comeback. Gator knows something that no one else does. The doctor says, I'll be able to jog. If I can jog, I can run. If I can run, I can box. When Gator gets ready to turn professional again, the boxing commission has to be convinced just to get, so he can get a probationary license. Gator's first professional fight on prosthesis is international news. When he knocks out his opponent in the second round, naysayers say the fight was fixed. Gator says, I'll take anyone on at any time. Gator goes on to win the Illinois Heavyweight Championship and the Intercontinental America Cruiserweight Championship. In 1990, Gator fights for the biggest belt in the world, the WBA World Championship. Gator puts up a great fight, loses by just a few points. After the fight, Gator apologizes to his girlfriend, who says, you just...
Okay, all right, Steve, okay. All right, Steve, that's good. I get the idea. All right, you know, it sounds like it could be a very interesting true story. You know, we spoke about things being visual before. Boy, there's nothing more visual than a one-legged boxer. I'd like to see that guy.
I can bring him over.
Oh, I'll bet you could. And so this guy's still alive.
Yeah, he fought in the 90s.
Okay, all right. Okay.
80s and 90s.
Okay.
I thought it'd be a great thing for Denzel or Mel Gibson to direct and or be the boxing commissioner.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. And I will take that under advisement. But all right, I'm going to put that on the list.
Thank you.
All right. But you know something? When he said the title, it sort of it faded out. So I'll just write one-legged boxer. I love that. One-legged boxer. All right, who's next?
All right, here we go. Sorry. Right. Next up is the writer on line 6-3. Number 6-3 is the number. Hello, you're live on Screen Talk Radio. Hello, you're live on Screen Talk Radio. All right, moving on to the writer on line. His number is 9-3. Hello, you're live on Screen Talk. You're live on Screen Talk Radio. Who are we speaking with?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, imagine that. Telephones work. Yay.
Hello?
I guess my sarcasm just.
you're scaring him off. Okay,
what happened?
The writer at 718 area code, and the last two digits are 82. Here you go. Hello, you're live at Screen Talk Radio. Who are we talking with?
718's in the house.
Hello, 718.
That's New York, right?
Oh yeah, New York City. My name is Joan.
Hey Joan, where are you in
New
York?
I'm not from Chicago for a change. Brooklyn Heights, right over the Brooklyn Bridge. Right over the Brooklyn Bridge, old
you
Brooklyn.
Know, Joan,
can you hear my nasal accent?
Joan, I'm from Staten Island.
Oh, I can take a ferry and I can meet you for lunch.
Well,
okay.
I'm not there now, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. Go ahead, Joan.
Okay, I have a very visual mystery suspense Hitchcockian thriller titled Rouge, which would be suitable for Denzel or Mel Gibson. The log line is the Parisian world of a jaded private eye straight from the movie Chinatown is consumed by shades of rouge when one beautiful redhead hires him to find her real family at the same time he's investigating the murder of another redhead, a stunning transvestite. As in Witness, the central plot is the powerful character relationships, while the subplot is the suspense-filled surrounding crime. Like many Hitchcock films, the answers lie somewhere between the world of the pristine and the bawdy. I am a produced screenwriter listed in IMDb with a film coming out this year titled The Message. And
thank
that's
you.
What I have to say. You want to ask me anything?
Listen, I just love the way you say bawdy. I used to say it
that bawdy, way too. Bawdy, yeah. Well, you know, in Brooklyn, we're bawdy.
I know, you're
bawdy in Brooklyn.
You're very bawdy. You know, listen, I think that in terms of when you're pitching, I think you really want to try to just stick strictly to the story elements. You want to try to avoid any of the additional hype and or getting a little bit too heady or, you know, esoteric, like the story lies between, you know, heaven and hell, because I don't know what any of that means, usually.
Okay, so we'll scratch that out.
But, you know, I think that, you know, it's like ultimately the movie, I'm assuming, is like some sort of film noirish.
Somewhat, I'm sorry.
Is it a little bit film noirish? You know, like along
little,
the lines of Chinatown?
Well, a little bit, because it's very visual.
Yes.
Extremely cinematic, extremely visual.
I see. And what makes it so cinematic and visual?
Well, you start at the very beginning when it's 20 years earlier, and you see a little red-headed tot in a convent.
This was a loaded question. All right.
Yes.
It's
sepia tones and its children, and then it blasts into a Technicolor cabaret where transvestites are entertaining. So you have this huge contrast.
Right. Well, listen, I'm a big lover of transvestites.
Okay.
So
is that personal?
if I were not at work right now, I'd probably be dressing up. So
okay. I have nice red high heels for you.
I'll bet you do. I'm on my way to Brooklyn right after this.
Okay.
All right,
okay.
Joan, thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Wow. All right, we got one-legged boxers hop around the room, and you wanted Steve on the list, right?
Transvestite. Yeah. I put Steve on the list.
And Joan, is that a pass?
Yeah, you know, I think that Joan's pitch was a little too, I think there was a little too much information. Lovely lady, great energy, which a lot of writers don't have. We clicked, I thought. But, yeah, I think that she probably could have wrangled in that pitch a little more and just stuck to the story elements without trying to sell all the other stuff.
Right. All right, we're going to move on now. Area code 818, your number is 93, last two digits. Hello, you're on your live Screen Talk Radio with Christopher Lockhart. Who are we speaking with?
Hi, you're talking to Rhonda from L.A.
Hey, Rhonda.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm thrilled, and I'll just get right to it, right?
Get right to it.
Okay, this is Bernadette, a film for the whole family with a great role model for teenage girls. This is based on a true story 150 years ago when the world was just as uncertain as it is now. A 14-year-old impoverished girl in France said she saw a miracle. No one believed her, but she kept her faith. They all tried to stop and crush her, but she kept her faith. They threatened her and her family, but she kept her faith. And then, just where she said it would be, the Spring of Lourdes appeared. People drank the waters, and they were cured. Today, 150 years later, over 20 million people a year of every faith visit this place, and over 20 million more send prayer petitions. This is your built-in worldwide audience, and they're waiting for the story of Bernadette.
All right, well, you know, I will say that there's actually already a project going around that I think is probably already financed, and they're actually trying to cast it. I can't think of the title offhand. I actually tried to look for it as you were pitching it, but I just don't recall it offhand. But it is, you know, the story of Bernadette of Lourdes. And so that project's out there already. And, you know, the thing is this, is that it's always a little bit dangerous if you are going to take a story that's in the public domain or one that everybody, you know, has access to or knows. I mean, Jennifer Jones won her Oscar, I think, for The Song of Bernadette.
Yes.
Right. So, you know, that story's out there already. So I think...
Okay. Christopher,
yes.
Can I just, since, you know, this is a great opportunity
sure, go ahead.
To have a chance to speak to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you had said, okay, this sounds good, then I was going to tell you the hook, which our version has that nobody else has.
You know something? I would let me just give you some advice. I would always lead or start off with the hook.
Okay.
Don't hide that, because you know if you really really believe that you have a hook that is going to make this different from all the other ones, then you got to let me know it. Hit me with it. So go ahead.
Okay.
Let me hear the hook.
Okay. The hook is ours is a musical. Ours is a musical. Think Fiddler on the Roof meets West Side Story.
All right. That isn't exactly the kind of hook that I hoped to hear, but yeah. You know, it's listen. You know, the thing about musicals right now is that they are making a comeback. And 5 years ago, we didn't see any sort of original musicals being made. There were only musicals that were from source material like Broadway.
Exactly.
Right, but now we're
original.
So, but I'm saying that, you know, that in the past, Hollywood didn't like original musicals. They liked to come from a Broadway source material.
Right,
but
right.
now we're starting to see that change a little bit, where
right.
there are some original musicals that are in development, like, for instance, Cleo, which is about Cleopatra. And Steven Soderbergh, I believe, is producing that. And that's a musical. So
that's our time, Chris. Should we put on a list
okay.
or consider a pass?
I think that would be a pass. It would be
all
a
right.
pass, yeah.
Thanks for calling, Rhonda. We're sorry.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Moving on, we're going to take from area code 619. Caller's last two digits are 91619. Hello, welcome to Screen Talk Radio. You are live. Who are we speaking with?
My name's Alberto. I'm from Vancouver, Canada right now.
Hey, Alberto.
Welcome.
Okay, my screenplay is entitled Matches. It's a quirky adventure romance in the style of A Life Less Ordinary and the TV show Dead Like Me that follows one suicidal man from a cardboard box stamper to death-defying hero. Harold, our main character, has no will to live. Unfortunately for him, he can't die. When a wooden match gets lost, his life goes into a tailspin adventure involving a Charles Bronson fanatic, killer bees, and a fat guy named Mo who works as Death. Unaware that Harold has a case of mistaken immortality, he continues to try to off himself, but in situations such as running into a burning building, jumping in front of a bank robber's bullet, he accidentally saves people and is seen as a hero, especially in the eyes of Janice, a paramedic. Tragedy is near when Harold learns life is worth living, just as Mo finds Harold's lost match. Harold fights for the life he once didn't want, ends up defying fate, and gets what he was searching for from the beginning, control of his destiny.
All right, so what does the lost match have to do with the protagonist? I'm a little bit confused on the connection there. What does have to do with anything?
Matches actually in my script represent people's lives, and so Death's job is really mundane, and all he does is light matches. And by fortunate fate, Harold's match gets lost. And so since he's suicidal, he can't kill himself, which sets up a whole mess in the afterlife because you can't have an immortal human being. So that's what...
Okay. And so throughout the movie, he's trying to kill himself. And we're rooting for him to kill himself? Is that what we're rooting for?
No, we're rooting because he just tries to kill himself once by himself, and then the rest of the movie he accidentally threw he runs back inside of a burning building and
right. Yeah, I heard that part. Right, but you know, listen, it's like the audience can only watch him try to kill himself maybe 1, 2, 3 times max. You know, you certainly can't make a 90-minute movie out of a guy trying to kill himself. At least I don't think so. That would be really, really hard to sell. And what does the audience root for, you know? It's like, what are we rooting for? It's like Die Hard, you know, we're rooting for him to save his wife. What are we rooting for in this story? So, you know.
That's our time limit, Chris. Is that going to be
okay.
a pass on that?
It's a pass. You know, it's a dark comedy. They can be sort of hard to sell, and I really didn't sort of hear the kind of cohesive through line that I think maybe would have made me say, there's definitely some fun elements in there, quirky, but overall it didn't work for me personally.
All right. Okay, next caller is Ariel 269. Your last two digits are 3 and 5.
Hey, so how's it going?
Live on Screen Talk Radio. Who are we speaking with?
This is Jason. I am in Price, Utah.
Utah, nice. Hey, Jason.
Yeah, so I'm far away from any of these other places people are coming from.
All right, well, hit us, Jason.
All right, I got a comedy. It's called Men for Hire, and it's about a guy named Noah, who's an emasculated vegan kindergarten teacher who decides to form a vigilante for hire group in order to prove his manhood and win back the girl of his dreams. His role model for masculinity is his brother, who's a vegetarian who teaches sixth grade.
All right, so you said that his I kind of missed. There was like a verb in there that I missed, which was
emasculated.
No, it was after all that where he joins or
he forms.
He forms. Okay.
He decides to take matters into his own hands. You know, take back the world and form a vigilante for hire group. So he gets together a cast of sort of strange rascals and characters and gets them together to form this team.
All right, and then you said his role model was his brother who...
Yeah, he forms the team with his brother, who is a vegetarian who teaches sixth grade.
Right, but isn't he a vegetarian also?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so you've got basically two characters who are the same, correct? You've got...
No. They're different shades of each other. He's the macho version of the vegan.
I see, okay, all right. All right, you know...
Can you run down some of the rest of the team? Can I give you a couple of the other guys?
Well, no, because you know something? They're not, you know why? Because they're not going to be the ones who are going to sell your script.
Okay.
They're not going to be the ones that are going to attract the big names. You know, it's ultimately going to be your protagonist. That's the guy that we have to focus on. I think so. Just very quickly, I think that for me, sort of, the setup isn't really all that interesting. You know, it's okay. So he's a nerdy guy that sets up a vigilante thing. I'm just not really sure why he does it. What's going on in his backstory? What happens in the first act that makes him do that? Why does he do that instead of joining a gym? You know,
that's our time, Chris. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We have 40 callers on hold.
Listen, you interrupt me whenever you want, but you know, I'm just going to ask questions, and that's fine. So I'm going to pass on that.
Okay, we're sorry, Jason. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you know something. By the way, nice guy, Jason. I thought did a very nice job.
Yeah, he did a very nice
job.
He did. I'm going to be interrupting quickly because we've got 40 people still on hold on our screen.
Do what you got to do.
All right, here we go. Next caller is from area code 727. Last two digits are 09. Hello, welcome. You are on Screen Talk Radio Live. Hello.
Hi, this is Randy Korn, Corn, a.k.a. Randall Towe, T-O-W-E. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well, thank
you. You're online, buddy. Go ahead.
Cool. Well, the title of my story is called The End of Time, and it's an apocalyptic science fiction thriller with an alien twist. The timeless struggle between the forces of light and darkness wage on as one man's obsession to uncover the truth and save his long-lost love, bring him face-to-face with the powers of creation, a quest that will test his strength of will, defy his sense of reality, and decide the fate of the world. With billions of lives hanging in the balance, failure is not an option as the battle against the forces of evil begins. A war to prevent a holocaust that will enslave the world in darkness forever. In the end, hope is all we have.
You know, the problem that I have with this pitch is that I really don't know what the movie is. You know, it's sort of all very poetic, but I don't know who the protagonist is. I don't know what it is that he's trying to do. You know, it's like, it's just, and you know, the one thing that I think screws everybody up when it comes to sci-fi is that it's always so complicated. And the best science fiction is very, very simple. You know, Planet of the Apes is about a planet of apes. RoboCop is about a RoboCop. It's very simple. You know, Minority Report is about pre-crime. Very simple, very good hooks, all of these things. But, you know, yours was just sort of big and bombastic, and I just know good versus evil, light versus dark.
Yeah.
I don't know what the aliens are. I don't have a clue who the protagonist is. I don't know who I can cast in this movie. It was just a lot of poetry, but no story. So that's a pass.
All right. Okay, thank you. Randy, thanks for calling. Please try back next time. All right, next caller is from area code 949. Your last two digits are 70. Hello, you're on live with Screen Talk Radio. Who are you speaking with and where are you from?
Hi, Laguna Niguel.
Oh, you spoiled man,
down,
you.
Right down the road in Orange County.
Hmm.
Okay, title is Marooned on Alcatraz. It's a comedy about a sleep disorder psychiatrist who has written a book debunking ghosts, angels, and all other paranormal illusions. He takes a tour of Alcatraz prison on Halloween with his family. He dresses as J. Edgar Hoover. In a storm requiring immediate evacuation, they miss the ferry and are marooned. During the night, they have to battle the convict ghosts of Alcatraz, who are forced to repeat their failed escape attempts from the rock. The convict ghosts want to capture J. Edgar Hoover so they can bargain for their release from purgatory. It's Ghostbusters meets Escape from Alcatraz.
And clearly, of course, J. Edgar Hoover's dead. And so is he a ghost in this also?
No. This guy is kind of a Bill Murray type lookalike who dresses. They put on their Halloween costumes.
Okay, and he goes dressed as who? As J. Edgar?
Edgar Hoover.
Okay. You didn't...
To the people in...
Yeah. Right. You didn't tell me that in the pitch, though, did you? Or did I zone out? Did you tell me that he dresses up as J. Edgar Hoover?
Yeah, I did.
You did earlier on, and I didn't hear that?
I probably went too fast.
Okay, yeah. I
think I caught that a little bit.
All right, so, you know, there's sort of an interesting, fun hook there, but, you know, you sort of spoke more about the ghosts and not enough about the protagonist. So I know that the ghosts are trying to, you know, get the J. Edgar Hoover guy, but what is our protagonist doing through the movie? You know,
well,
what's he doing?
He's trying to protect his family from the ghosts. He has a wife and a daughter and a young son.
Right, and so how and like he does it how?
Well, they all have various people that are running after him, from Capone, Machine Gun Kelly,
right,
Birdman.
Right, right. But so is it just one scene they're being chased by Al Capone, one scene they're being chased by Machine Gun Kelly, one scene they're doing this? You know, remember, you always want to pitch your story from the point of view of the protagonist. What is the protagonist doing? That's you know, that is key, because if you're not pitching that, then my guess is that the protagonist doesn't have all that much to do.
That's our time.
All right, thank you.
Go ahead and finish your point. We'll go ahead and you want him on the pass list or the...
It's a pass. Although, you know, it's sort of a fun idea, but to me it sounded more like a concept and not a story.
Right. All right. Okay, move on. So do you think Lisa and Steve are, like, cheering you on here, shooting people down? They're, like, the only two that we have on the case. They're like, yeah, go, Chris. All right, here we go. Next caller, you're from the area code of 906. Last two digits are 88. Hello, welcome to Screen Talk Radio. You're on live. Who are we speaking with and where are you from?
Thank you. My name is Janet, and I'm from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Wow, there we go.
Welcome, Janet.
My script is entitled Trojan Horses, and it is based on the true adventure of a disabled widow who travels 1,000 miles to help the animals affected by Katrina. Arriving in Jackson, Jillian Gray finds herself at the center of the chaos, handling rescue calls and directing flood of donations. Almost too late, she learns that Mississippi troopers are turning away the trucks still loaded with critical supplies and feed. Then she learns FEMA is restricting the movements of the professional emergency responders while government snipers are in the disaster zone.
Okay, you know something? You know something?
Yep.
I think that you probably summed up the story very well in your log line, which most people haven't been doing.
Okay.
So I kind of get it. I think that my first question would be, how old is the character and who do you see playing her?
Mid-40s, Ashley Judd.
Okay, all right. Okay, and it's called what?
Trojan Horses.
Trojan Horses, yeah. It, you know, it sounds a little bit maybe, you know, a little bit more TV movie of the week-ish than, you know, than a feature film, at least in terms of the pitch. Maybe the writing isn't, you know, quite TV movie of the week-ish. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course. But, okay, you know, I get it. I'd put that on the consider list.
Right.
Just, you know, it was a pretty clear, concise pitch for the most part.
All right,
Jan, so keep listening, and you'll find out later on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next caller, you're from the area code 310, and your last two digits are 00. Hello, welcome to Screen Talk Radio. You're on live. Who are you, and where are you from?
My name is Hernando. I'm from
Bangalore. All right, welcome.
How are you? I didn't think I'd get through.
Where are you from, Hernando? I didn't hear that.
Beverly Hills.
Up, Hernando. All right.
I'm calling from work.
Like right around the corner from me, Hernando. You can just meet me out on the street
exactly.
And do this instead of taking up everybody's time. But all right, go ahead.
It's a drama called The Chairman Speaks.
Okay.
Michael Clayton meets Network. It's a story about a media mogul who is so besieged by the current economic recession, he decides to end his life by jumping off the GWB in New York City. Jeffrey Hall is a fading titan of the newspaper business. He's taken to a local hospital, where he forms a beautiful bond with a black nurse. His two estranged sons form an alliance to take revenge on their father and to attempt to disrupt his newfound hope. Familial turmoil escalates into war in the media as secrets and ancient truths are finally unearthed. It's like Wall Street, Michael Clayton, Network.
Right, and so I'm just... I'm just a little bit confused, and which, by the way, is never a good thing. Just in regards to what is it that the protagonist is trying to do through the movie? He's trying to do what?
Keep his business going.
He's trying to keep his business going. All right. Okay. It sounds like it's probably topical, but I don't know. It just sort of lacked the intrigue of Michael Clayton for me. You know, maybe because the pitch sort of got a little bit too wordy,
right.
And, you know.
Yeah.
I think maybe. Okay.
Ooh,
go ahead, Chris.
In the past list. Thank you for calling in. Okay, next
Thank
caller.
Thank you, Hernando. I appreciate it.
Next caller, I don't have anything for, but it's been on there for a while, so we'll see who this is. Hello, welcome. You're live on Screen Talk Radio. Say hello.
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
Hi.
Who's speaking with?
My name is Yolanda. I'm from North Carolina.
Hey, Yolanda.
Hi. The title of my screenplay is Rise of the Phoenix, Legend Begins. A child born from the erupting of a volcano on a mysterious island grows to become the Phoenix. Even as he struggles to understand his destiny, enter Mr. Sandman, master of dreams, a debonair but deadly Poe-quoting character empowered by the evil Prince of Tyre in his battle to take over New Canaan, the town for which the Phoenix serves as guardian. Phoenix must race the clock for a cure after Mr. Sandman places all of the city officials in a sleep in which they must face their greatest fears forever. When battle in hell, is best not to be afraid of fire.
All right, you know, still, it's interesting that a lot of these pitches that I'm hearing are sort of very, again, kind of poetic and trying to toss in taglines and stuff like that instead of just kind of telling me the story, you know, which I think would really tend to behoove the pitch a little bit more. And does the Phoenix have the ability to move in and out of the dream world?
I went and lost her on that.
Oh, that's okay. You know something? I would have. No. It's a pass.
Okay. All right, I'm sorry, Linda.
Sorry, Linda.
Next caller is from 619 area code 57. Are your last two digits? Hello. Welcome to Screen Talk Radio. You're live. Who are you and where are you from?
Chris, this is Scott in San Diego.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
Hey, things are good. I got a father. He's got a 16-year-old daughter, and he's decided that she's old enough to tell her his secret why he kidnapped her from a foreign land years earlier. And he flashes back to his first meeting with the mother and goes into the ill-fated marriage. But this daughter they have is his anchor, and that's what's grounded him in life. And he'll do anything to hold on to her. So he's buried in this little German village, and he teams up with this local thief and purchases narcotics and plants it on the mother. But a week, immigrations is giving him just a week to leave the country or be extradited, and he steals his passport and gets a bunch of fake documents for his daughter and a life on the run. And this true story continues with him eluding Interpol on a 9-day journey with his daughter seeking passage back to the States. And he finds an airport in England where his 4-year-old daughter is hiding inside his backpack, and he outwits customs and boards a plane bound for Chicago. And when he gets inside,
okay, all right. So the story is about this man who is eluding the authorities for some reason, I guess because he kidnapped his daughter?
He is going to be extradited out of a foreign country, and he will not leave his daughter. So he finds a way to bring her back to the States.
I see.
After
and
not winning custody. In
okay, and so the story is basically about him trying to get the girl back to the States?
Yes, and he has no passport for her, so
right.
He smuggled
okay, okay.
her.
Yeah, okay. And because, you know, you sort of start out with some, like, flashbacks and stuff, so I'm just sort of – I was a little bit confused. I'm not really sure where we are in time. And so is the entire story told in flashback?
Most of the story is – the beginning is current day, flashes back 17 years earlier when he meets the mother and they have this ill-fated marriage and a daughter.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Why do you choose to tell the story that way? Why don't you just have it take place unfolding currently? Why do you choose to do it that way? Right from the start, we'll know that he succeeded because it's been 17 years.
I want you to believe that, but you're wrong. Because I want everyone throughout the entire movie to believe that he has succeeded, but in the end he did not. He did lose, and the child is taken away for many years. The child then returns many years later looking for answers.
All right, Chris, that's our time.
Okay.
What do you say about this story?
I'll tell you, it has a little bit of intrigue. I like the fact that it's a true story, but I am a little bit confused about sort of the jumping through time elements. I'm not really sure exactly how the narrative works from beginning to end, and I think on that note, it would be a pass for me.
All right, next caller, your area code's 412. Your last two digits are 81. Hello, welcome to Screen Talk Radio. You're live. Who are you? Where are you from?
Hi, guys. My name is Arlen, and I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Arlen. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm trying to revise on the fly. I'm trying to and put things in. I've got a draft of a period costume drama based on the life of the first woman to ever receive a college degree. She's a 17th century Italian noblewoman. She's defied her father who wants to arrange a marriage for her, and instead he gives her a philosopher from the local university to study with. She doesn't like him. She doesn't think that he's religious enough, and she finds herself battling between the spiritual world and the secular world. He ends up getting her into a life-threatening situation.
One of her friends ends up blackmailing him, and in the end, her father ends up striking a deal with the Catholic Church in order to get her a degree that she doesn't really want in the first place.
And is did you say that this was set in Italy?
Yeah.
Or is she just an Italian?
No, no, it is set in Italy, primarily in Venice and Florence, so it's got the potential to be a beautiful, golden-looking film.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, clearly the fact that it's period and costume makes it a very, very hard sell, especially for a first-time writer. The fact that it doesn't take place in America makes it that much even harder. And so it's not really about her sort of struggling to get into school and struggle to stay in school as a woman. No, it's not.
Actually, she was a child prodigy, and her father uses her for his own political gain. She actually wants to be left alone, but she's forced into the spotlight.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go.
All right, Chris. Well, what do you think? Consider a pass.
No, I'm going to pass on it only because, I, again, I'm still not really sure exactly what it is that she's doing through the movie, and she's the star. You know, I heard what the friend does, I heard what the father does, but I didn't hear what she does, and it's like if I have to pitch that to an actress, how do I pitch that? I say, well, listen, it's a really great part because this other actress does this, and this other actress is going to do this, and this other actress is going to do this, and you're just going to want to be left alone. And that just doesn't sound like the most exciting role.
All right, next caller. Your area code is 480. Last two digits are 6-3. Hello, welcome. You're on Screen Talk Live. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Rick, and I'm calling from Scottsdale, sunny Scottsdale.
Hello, Rick.
Well, thanks for picking up my call. I called before and got lost, and I thought, there's no way I'm going to get back in.
Well,
all right, we're taking care of you.
All right, well, here we go. I thought that this would be good for Mel Gibson, something that he could sink his teeth into.
All right.
Have you ever wondered where vampires come from, why they would thirst for human blood, or why they would cower at a cross? Well, Final Blood, a fantasy actioner, runs red with the answers as it reimagines the vampire myth. As France recovers after World War I, a reluctant vampire named Henri discovers that the fallen angel, Baphomet, who birthed the vampire races, is out to destroy mankind through yet another world war. Henri refuses to join in the bloodshed, but is introduced by a mysterious stranger to a beautiful female Templar knight who aims to find the Holy Grail because it alone has power over Baphomet. But will they succeed when she learns that not only is Henri a vampire, but before becoming one had been a Templar knight himself, the very one who unleashed Baphomet on the earth 700 years ago?
So who's the protagonist, him or her?
Henri. It has a romantic partnership in it, but
and what's he trying to do through the movie again? Then I'm sorry, what's he trying to do? Because I heard what she's trying to do. What is he trying to do?
He's refusing to join Baphomet in this attempt to restart world war, and he's solicited by a mysterious stranger who actually turns out to be an angel, and the partnership of the female Templar knight and Henri.
Okay, all right. Okay, Rick.
Their core to the story.
Okay, listen, you know, I am not a fan of these sort of gothic vampire things. Me personally, I like a really simple, easy pitch, like 30 Days of Night, you know, something that has a really good hook. And, you know, this is sort of, you know, and anytime I hear anything that sounds like it's an old Hammer vampire thing, it just doesn't appeal to me, so it's a pass.
All right, moving on. Next caller, area code 512, last two digits, 48. Hello, welcome. You're Screen Talk Live. Who are you? Where are you from?
Hello, my name's Joseph. I'm from Austin.
Hey, Joseph.
Hey, Chris. Huge fan. Anyways, the title of my first log line is an action thriller. It's called The Bullet Has a Soul. A corrupt cop is given the task of redeeming his department's reputation by catching a celebrity vigilante who has captured the public's imagination by assassinating high-profile crime figures.
That's a really good title. And so, when you say a celebrity vigilante, can you
basically, the idea is that the vigilante becomes a huge celebrity. You know,
I see.
Like,
okay.
You know, so he's like a trend almost, and the cop, though, the corrupt cop, is on the take by the mobsters who he's taken out, so it's kind of this conflict of interest.
Okay, all right. You know, just the title alone puts you on the list. That's kind of a good title.
Thank you.
All right, Joseph, thank you. Stay tuned. All right, so next up is caller from area code 705. Your last two digits are 00.
Hi there.
Hello, welcome to
Screen
Talk Radio. You're live. Who are we?
I'm calling from Barrie, Ontario. My name is Heather.
Hey, Heather.
Hey there. Thank you very much for taking my call. The name of my script is called Be My Guest, and my tagline is When the Flavor of the Month Goes Bad. Simon Guest is North America's answer to Jamie Oliver. Among other things, he's got a hot line of overpriced cookware, a fan club full of floozies, and bad hair. But vis-a-vis a series of unfortunate events, including his wife of 25 years leaving him for their landscaper and the mysterious torching of his five-star restaurant, Simon snaps and becomes the unfortunate laughingstock of trash rags and gossip columns. While Simon falls from the A-list to the D-list, he watches his new girlfriend, Carrie Reed, some 20 years his junior, make her own personal transition from a sweet and simple single-parenting bookstore maven to a best-selling author and neglectful parent with an obnoxious quest for fame addiction. In short, Carrie is turning into the old Simon. All the while, Simon's seeking guidance from his best friend's widow, Janice, with whom he finds himself falling in love with, while dishing out a healthy dose of retribution.
Okay.
We got 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's a pass. It just doesn't have enough of a hook. I kind of like the character, but it just sounds like it's just this sort of, you know, character-driven thing that just doesn't sound all that interesting for me personally.
All right,
pass.
We're going to go take one more quick caller, and you got 30 seconds, area code 501.
30 seconds? What, are you kidding me?
Yeah, here we go. All right, you're on Live Street Talk Radio. Who are we speaking with?
In Arkansas. Hello.
Uh-oh. 30 seconds to this guy. Okay, go ahead.
We got a two-story baseball story. A story about Gene Bearden, an obscure minor league baseball player, battles through the effects of his war injuries to become a rookie sensation and lead the Cleveland Indians to a one-game playoff for the 48 World Series.
Okay.
Right. Lefty was discovered when he was working part-time in the Hollywood studio.
Yes. Is it still part of that same pitch?
Yes.
Okay, I don't need to hear any more. That's fine. You know, that was good enough.
What's your name, sir?
Mike Murphy.
What's your name, sir?
Mike.
All right.
Hang on.
And what was that script called again? It was called what? All right, Mike is gone. All right.
I have his. Hey, that's our time, Chris.